The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. And should we turn some of the lights on, or we like it this way, subdued? Lights? That's the wrong switch. Yeah. There we go. Great. Thank you. I was told that when they originally built this church in early 1950s, a member of the congregation was a local engineer who went a little bit overboard in engineering the light system. And including, I don't know if we still have this big wheel. I mean, if you ever noticed our historical wheel in the back over there, that's for turning piloting the boat. It's for, it's a dimming switch for the lights. So, and the people in the outer hall are happy sitting in the dark? Okay. Out in the dark. The one announcement I'd like to make is that it's two Saturdays from now that we're going to have our big fundraising event here for our retreat center, and we're calling it a fundraiser because it's supposed to be fun. Wes Nisker is going to come. Wes Nisker is a Dharma teacher, who's also a wonderful comedian and relic from the 60s. and a harbinger from the future. And a wonderful man, very funny. And so we're going to do this kind of unusual event here at IMC. Kind of a nice, fun event with reception and various things happening here. As a fundraiser, it's one of the few events we ever do here that we're asking people to make a donation beforehand to buy a ticket or to buy a share in our IPO, in our initial practice opportunity that we're creating for our retreat center. So you're all welcome to come, and if you want to buy a ticket or buy a share or buy merit or whatever inspires you, I think there's flyers out there to tell you how to do that. So, for the talk today, I think I still would like to continue a little bit with the kind of momentum of the talks of the last 4 weeks, I think. And last week I talked about the Dharma, and the Dharma being something which the Buddha described as being visible here and now, something you can attain, experience, and see in a very simple, direct way, not in a mystical way. Sometimes Dharma has mystical associations, but I think his definition of how to see the Dharma here and now was not mystical or supernatural or mysterious, but rather was in the very ordinary way in which we could see at times how our mind is caught and how our mind is uncaught, how the mind is with greed and how its mind went without greed, when the mind's with hate and when it's without hate. Very simple movement of the mind. And so the practice in Buddhism has a big part of being is interior, where you have to be able to look at your own mind or your own heart in a deep way. And the process of doing that puts us on what's called in Buddhism a path, magga in Pali. And what I wanted to do today is to talk about three different understandings of the path, how the path can unfold for people. And part of the motivation for this is to convey or explain that the path is this can be seen from different vantage points, different ways in which it unfolds. but also that it unfolds differently for different people, and it also unfolds differently for different people at different stages of their life, or different stages of their practice, or different phases of life. And it's very easy to talk about the practice from choose one of these three modes of talking about it. And some people specialize in one mode more than the other. And it seems like this is what it's all about. And then either people feel strongly connected, oh, this is for me, this is right, or they feel like this leaves me out because it doesn't meet me in phase of my life where I'm at. Or the kind of personality I have or something. And as a teacher, one of the challenges is to be aware of these different modes of practice, different ways of the path can unfold for people, and how to teach in a way that doesn't limit people to just one of them. So this is, or give people the impression this is the truth and the right way. So the three modes or three understandings of the path of practice that I'd like to offer are the path of cultivation, the path of letting go, and the path of no path. Now, the path of cultivation, development, comes from the Pali word bhavana, and bhavana means something like to make something come into being. It's used for cultivating, like cultivating plants. It's sometimes translated as development. And it points to the very human capacity of developing ourselves, of growing in a variety of ways, inner growth. And it's something that all humans have, not only as a capacity, but something all humans go through, development and growth. And you see it most pronounced in children. You see a gradual, progressive developmental stages in children as they grow up. And it's a pretty good guess that the day that you became an adult, 18, 21, 32, whatever it was, if you became an adult.
Still waiting.
73. That the day that you became an adult, that the developmental growth didn't stop then. That we continue to grow and develop into our adulthood. And in fact, for most of us, I think if you're already, you know, advanced in ages, if enough, you can look back at your early adulthood and you'll probably see that you've changed quite a bit, that you have grown, developed certain capacities, that you have in wisdom and understanding, that you're in some ways a different person than you were when you were in your 20s. And so it's a very ordinary part of human life, the developmental stages that people go through. Sometimes those development stages go faster or slower depending on what life occurs to us as we live our lives. Some people encounter some of the tremendous challenges of life very early on, where they get sick, or someone they know die, or their parent dies when they're still a child themselves, or they go through war, or there's all kinds of unexpected traumas, tragedies, challenges that people experiences, and that can happen any time in life. Some people are not prepared for the huge challenges. Some people have a philosophy of life that doesn't allow themselves to, you know, they've been fortunate enough, everything's going along well, and so they have a philosophy of life which kind of doesn't have space for dealing with tragedy because they haven't really visited it, or they haven't prepared themselves. They don't have the wisdom, the mindfulness, the equanimity, whatever it takes to really go through a tragedy that might come along. And some people have. Some people have developed it painfully, not because they practice, but because they've been alive through it all. And I've met people who've never had any contact with Buddhist practice who are wiser than some Buddhists I know because of how they've been matured in the process of dealing with the challenges of their life. So the idea that there can be development and growth is something the Buddha emphasized. In fact, he said very explicitly that the path that he was teaching is a gradual path, gradual step-by-step path. And so One would start with something like cultivating one's ethical foundation, ethics considered foundation, so one's integrity. And one would not start with meditation, but would start with refraining from killing and stealing and sexual misconduct and lying and engaging in getting drunk or intoxicated with drugs or alcohol. And that it takes, for some people, it's a huge task to get their ethical foundation established. And it's part of their growth and maturation is to do that. And then one would develop meditation practices, the bhavana, the cultivation of concentration, or of loving kindness, or of mindfulness, and the variety of the kind of mental qualities that come along with this inner development of the mind. Things like equanimity, patience, energy, compassion, joy, delight, tranquility. You know, a variety of inner qualities that can become stronger and stronger. And you can meet practitioners who you can see, you can tell, you can feel that their equanimity is quite strong and developed, or their calm is well developed, or their capacity for mindfulness is quite strong, their presence is really there, tangible, you feel a sense of presence with them. And they weren't always like that, but after practicing for some time, these qualities get stronger and stronger. And it's quite inspiring to see. And it's been very important for me in the course of my practice to have encountered people who have practiced before me, people who are further along than me in a sense, and to see, not just know about them, but to actually witness how they go through their life and see the presence and the compassion and the kindness that they have. And it's inspired me to kind of cultivate some of those myself as well. So the path of cultivation. Traditionally said you start with ethics, then with meditation, and then with that as a foundation, then the next stage is wisdom or insight. You cultivate your wisdom and insight to have a deeper understanding of this life that we're living. And this, in turn, hopefully leads to liberation. So here, liberation is sometimes seen as the end result of a path of practice. There's a goal, and that goal is found by walking a gradual path that leads there. Some people find that this idea of a gradual path very inspiring, very meaningful. It can give some people the deepest sense of meaning in their life, because to have a path, something you can do that can make a difference for yourself and for others, some of the deepest existential issues that all human beings have to face, can give much more meaning in life than a career or having money or, you know, many of the things that people pursue. And but to cultivate the deep abiding sense of wisdom and peace, compassion, to show that it's possible to set the heart deeply at peace and to share that peace with the world, I think is a beautiful thing. So some people find that this is very meaningful, to have a sense of a path and growth and development. You can do something. Other people find it very discouraging. In a variety of different reasons, they find it discouraging. One is, I can't do that. That's too hard. It's too difficult. Or, you know, in my circumstances of my life, I mean, it's just oppressive to hear about this stuff and develop your concentration and wisdom and go on retreats. I mean, I have all these kids at home and I have to work and I have to do all this stuff to do. And I think this Buddhist path is meant for really monks. And they don't seem to understand lay people and how lay people are supposed to, you know, and the challenges they have. And I don't feel like I could, this works for me, because I can't see how I can develop myself. Or there's other arguments, other reasons people get discouraged. Some is that the path of development lends itself to idealism. There's this great ideal of what you can get. And I've known people here at IMC even, who have gotten really, really caught in the idealism of attaining something through this gradual path, and then they huff and they puff, and the house doesn't fall. The only thing that falls apart is them, and you know, it just they don't get anywhere. Partly because of the way they're practicing. If you're straining and puffing to, you know, get calm. You know, it kind of doesn't work. And so the idea, so some people then feel very discouraged because they put tremendous amount of effort. There's no shortage of effort for some people in following the developmental path, but it doesn't lead very far for them, or it doesn't lead where they want to go, and so they get really discouraged by it in the end. And then there are people who follow it, who actually slowly follow it. Sometimes they don't even know they're following it. They realize in retrospect that they look back after 5 years or 10 years and say, wow, I've really come a long way compared to where I was at. I didn't see the changes over time. They were so gradual that they were imperceptible from day to day, but over time I really changed. One of my favorite analogies for the change that happens as people engage in practice is that of two parallel lines. You know what they say, I haven't followed it to the end, but they say that two parallel lines never meet. And they just stay equal distance from each other. But if you take one of the lines and nudge it ever so slightly off to the side, and then you follow it, then initially they'll look parallel still. Initially they won't look much different from the distance. But slowly over time, they diverge further and further and further until eventually they're quite far apart. So a little difference in one's practice, little difference in changing one's life, with one's ethics, one's mindfulness, one's concentration, small change might not seem very big today or tomorrow or next week, but in 5 years, it can be a huge difference where it takes you in your life. And it might seem that 5 years is so far in the future. Who would want to bother thinking about 5 years from now? But if you remember how quickly the last 5 years went, then practicing for 5 years from now is, that's goes pretty quickly. So for some people, that it's really meaningful and inspiring to see how much they change, and the idea of that there's cultivation and growth gives them a lot of faith and confidence in both the practice of Buddhism, following a path, and a lot of confidence in themselves, confidence that they can change and they can change for the better. The other, the next kind of mode or understanding of the path is the path of letting go. And some teachers specialize in this, where if you say you want to develop anything, they'll pull the rug from under that. They'll say, no way, there's nothing to develop, or that's going the wrong way. Or one of the common critiques I've heard is that if you're focusing on developing something, on a goal, then you'll miss the present moment. Because if you're so caught up in the goal, looking for the goal, measuring yourself against the goal, you're really concerned about a future, a virtual, imaginary world in the future. And so you miss the vibrancy of life here and now. And so you should just forget about goals and focus on, just let go of that and focus on here and now. Or there are teachers who say there is nothing ultimately to attain. It's mostly practice is about unattaining. And we have to, the whole idea of attaining lends itself to egoism, being self-centered, selfish, and I'm the one who's attained, I'm the most enlightened person in my block, thank you. That's, in Buddhism, there's not much freedom in that, but there's freedom in just in letting go of the clinging, letting go of selfishness, letting go of attachment to self, letting go of attachment to things and to people or whatever. And so it's about just letting go, let go, let go, let go. And I've known practitioners who have followed the path of letting go to great benefit to them. They just kind of, every time their mind gets involved in something, they let go. They let go. They don't let anything linger in their mind. They don't get involved in anything. They just let go, let go, let go. And since most stress, most suffering comes from preoccupation, comes from being attached to something, a letting go can relieve a tremendous amount of suffering and can make a radical revolution in people's hearts and minds of who they are. It's hard to the path of letting go because it doesn't offer anything, or seemingly doesn't offer much. Sometimes it's easier to believe in agency. I can do something. There's some place I can get, if it's just about letting go, it's kind of like then you don't do anything at all. And if I can't do anything at all, then I'm not safe. I'm not developing myself. I'm not getting a badge. to show that I'm a good spiritual person, successful person. And it just feels like kind of letting go leaves me with nothing. And then, you know, that feels very like nothing. And, you know, feels it makes people feel more vulnerable or empty or kind of nihilistic or something. And, you know, you go to some teachers who teach letting go and say, but this path leads to nothing. And the teacher just beams and smiles. That's right. Isn't that great? And So when I was doing the Zen tradition, practicing in Zen, there I got the sense that one of the primary techniques of the practice, approaches back to, was pulling the rug from any place you wanted to stand, any place you wanted to hold on to anything, any goal, any desire, any attainment. You know, heaven forbid you go to a Zen master and say you have experienced some kind of deep meditative experience, realization experience or attainment. They'll just look at you and say, great, something else to let go of. And you don't hold on to that even. And you just go on. And, you know, you go to a Zen teacher and you say, it happens a lot. So, you know, you really want to go tell your teacher, some teacher, about this great meditation experience you had last year or last week. And for, you know, these, especially Zen masters, I mean, last week? I mean, that's disappeared into the time of the pharaohs. You know, who could care less about last week? You know, it's about now. Now is what's important. And you're still caught up in what you happened last week. Last week, I attained no self. I attained no self. Who could care less what happened last week? What matters is, you know, for a Zen master, you go see a Zen master, what matters is now and how you meet now, how you manifest yourself now. And a lot of that has to do with letting go of anything that gets in the way of just being here. Some people find the path of letting go very meaningful, partly because it's a path that has most directly sometimes frees the religious life from involvement with metaphysics and supernatural beliefs of a variety of different kinds. And religion often has, you know, all kinds of supernatural beliefs that are built into it. When main emphasis is on non-clinging, because clinging is painful, that little movement from, or big movement from clinging to non-clinging doesn't require any supernatural belief. So the path of non-clinging, and some people specialize in this, just that's all you do, just let go, let go, let go. Sometimes, though, some people find it meaningful. For some people, it's not helpful to do it because maybe they can't let go so easily. I've been, guilty of basically telling that to people. You know, when I was first starting to be a teacher, sometimes just someone would come to me with their difficulties and challenges, and I would, you know, help, you know, try to be helpful for sure. But basically, I'd say something like, "Oh, just let go." And then I had kids and family and all this. And then I realized, wait, you know, it's not that easy, you know. It's more complicated and more involved and, you know, all the different, you know. And so, it can be overly simplistic, the teaching of just let go, and it doesn't respect the complexity of lives and the complexity of our own minds and all that. It also is discouraging for some people because, or it undermines some people because sometimes when you have a really strong emphasis on just spirituality, just of non-clinging, people get the impression that they're not allowed to develop themselves in any way because that's too goal-oriented, that's too dualistic, or a variety of different things people will say. And so it's not okay to develop one's patience. It's not okay to try to work on one's anger so you don't get so angry so much anymore. It's not so okay to develop yourself. That's self-help. Go to the self-help section of the bookstore then if you want that. But, you know, Buddhism, that's about something more profound, non-dualistic, immediate, here and now. Just let go. And we won't worry about your anger. sometimes, you know, people feel undermined or feel like, you know, they're not, you know, some of the very, very basic, ordinary capacities of growth and development and maturation aren't given any respect in that kind of system. So the third understanding of the path and that you see in Buddhism is the path of no path. In some ways, maybe not so different from the path of letting go, but the path of no path, you don't even let go. Sometimes the emphasis here is just on being. Just be. Just be as it is. Sometimes a variety of this kind of just no path, it's enough just to be mindful. That a moment of mindfulness, of clear mindfulness, that itself is freedom right there. Freedom is not to be attained in the future, some future retreat, some future developmental time, but freedom is found in a moment of unobstructed, non-reactive mindfulness right here and now. Or sometimes the path of no path is couched in the language of non-dualism. Then any kind of idea of being dualistic, there's a goal and a means to the goal is dualistic. There's me, and there's I and me practicing. That's dualistic. There is attainments being and non-attainments. That's a dualistic thing. And the idea is to kind of just drop all dualism and realize a non-dualistic presence. The focus on non-path, sometimes you find people emphasizing the present moment is perfect, just the way it is. Yet somehow you wake up, and so the emphasis is waking up. Sometimes you find in this non-path path that occasionally you find that they rely a lot more on teachers, because you need a teacher to wake you up. You need a teacher to point you, to point out the place of non-dualism, the place of no attainment, the place of no path. And so sometimes you develop, have very charismatic teachers then, who in their charisma or in their power or something, in their presence, people kind of like get jolted or get kind of, something different happens to them, that they kind of experience something that's immediate and present here and now. I've known people who have relied on teachers like that, where they keep having to go back. They don't have a path. There's no path. There's no practice. There's nothing to do. But you have to get it, whatever it is. And it's hard to know what it is exactly, because it's not anything. And some people get it, which is, you know, genuinely. I'm not saying it's not real. But some people... So I've known people who keep going back to get a hit. And they keep coming back to get a hit from the charismatic teacher who points to it, something. The non-path is a beautiful teaching. It's sometimes said that that teaching from the point of view of there's no path, of non-dualism or something like that, is pointing or describing the world from the point of view of how a Buddha would see it. Or someone who's finish the path. There's no more path to go. And so you see without any greed, hate, and delusion. You see without any being caught by anything. And so in that not being caught by anything, there's a kind of a way in which things seem perfect. Not that there aren't problems in the world that are addressed, but there's no contraction, there's no resistance in the mind to being present for these things. And so because there's no resistance in the field of awareness, and everything happens in that field of awareness, there's a feeling somehow of perfection, fullness or completion that's here. The path of no path, a little bit like the path of non-clinging, points sometimes very powerfully and beautifully to presence, full immediacy of now, and the vitality, the fullness. And rather than, life becomes technicolor, whereas the path of development sometimes can be black and white because the goal isn't far in the future. The path of development, sometimes you find teachers who emphasize then a lot of techniques. You try this technique, you do this here, you do that here, you develop a whole repertoire of techniques that you hold on to. The path of letting go, the path of no path, they almost kind of are very dismissive of techniques because techniques get in the way of that sense of immediacy. Immediate presence, right here, right now. And some people have a more easy access to a powerful sense of vital immediacy. Some people, it's not so easy to feel that in a meaningful way. Maybe because their suffering is so great, or because their inner mental life is so strong that it obscures the sense of immediacy and vitality and presence that can feel very rich and alive. Some people can experience a sense of meaningful immediacy after a silent meditation retreat, going into a retreat for a week or something. So much of the proliferation of mental abstract thinking and planning and memories and preoccupations fall away. And as those fall away, the sense of vitality, of aliveness, of presence, of now becomes stronger, usually in a calmer or more meaningful way. And then we leave the retreat and we pick up our concerns again. And pretty soon those concerns become like filters over our eyes that we don't really see clearly anymore. So some people have easier access, for I don't know, for whatever reason, to a sense of immediacy that's very meaningful. They feel alive. There's nothing that's needed. There's no their sense of deep trust in life, because just to be alive is enough. Nothing has to happen. We don't have to attain anything. And some people, for whatever reason, really, that's meaningful. They have a deep trust in the Dharma, deep trust in the practice, or the deep trust in just awareness, being aware. Other people, you teach them the path of no path, and they flounder, because their minds, their attachments, their cut-upness, their suffering is just kind of swirling around. They're caught in it. And kind of what they're hearing is, just accept it. There's nothing you can do. You know, you're deluded, you're dualistic. You know, and you know, just you know, and you know, just get over it, and relax, and trust in some deep way, or something like that. And so some people are just like, you know, just they feel like they're hitting their head against a wall, or they're just perplexed. They don't even understand what's being talked about. And so there's three paths: path of cultivation, the path of letting go, and the path of no path. They're all three, I think, are quite beautiful. They both have their strengths and their weaknesses. And I like to think of it as that in different phases of people's lives, different ones stand out. At different phases of practice, if you could follow the developmental path, there are times when clearly you're cultivating something, and there's clearly at times when mostly what you're doing is letting go, and that's the phase of development you're in. And then other times where you realize that it doesn't make any sense to even let go, that what's required now in your practice is just a very clear presence, being present for things, being rather than doing, just being present. And then that changes. And then you have to do something else. You go back to the development. These can, over months and years, you might go in and out of these different things. Or at different times, different ones get emphasized. It could be that when you go to work, that the most useful thing for you to do at work is to cultivate and develop your capacity for patience with your boss. And that's how the world is best served. But perhaps when you go home, maybe the best thing, and sit down to meditate, the best thing to do in your meditation is just to be and not to do anything, just to have no path, no concern for a goal, just to be. And perhaps when you, in other situations in life, it's best just practice letting go, letting go, letting go, maybe. So I'm very reluctant to position any of these three understandings of the path against each other and to claim that one is the right way or the true way and the only way and the others are somehow wrong or deluded or something. I think it's wisest to see them as being partners in this whole approach. And as partners at different times, different phases, different situations in life, different ones of them take prominence. As a teacher, as trying to teach something as a Buddhist teacher, I would like people to have the sense that there is cultivation and development and growth, there is a path, there is a place to go in practice that can lead someplace beautiful that's not where you're right now. And at the same time, I'd like to convey the tremendous richness and value of presence here and now. That just this moment of mindfulness here is beautiful and profound. And to be able to hold those together, and not one against the other, which I see sometimes in Dharma circles. And so the analogy that I like to give for this is, maybe I apologize if I've given this here recently, is that of going for a walk on a mountain trail. And you can walk on the trail for different purposes. You can go for a walk just to enjoy the walk. And if you just go out there to enjoy the walk, then getting to the end of the path, the end of the trail, is not really the point of the walk, you know. You're out there to enjoy the vista, enjoy the walk, and so you kind of race through the forest, race through the mountain to get to the other end as quickly as you can, not noticing anything. You know, that's not the point. The point then is just to walk and maybe in a leisurely pace and just enjoy what you see and the experience of walking. Another way of walking the mountain trail is to get to the other place. Maybe it's important to get there. That's all that's important. And so then getting there as quickly as you can is what's important. And so you walk fast and safely, hopefully. But you just can, you know, it doesn't really matter what you see around you. What matters is you get there quickly. Depending on what we're doing in life, sometimes it's enjoying the view and sometimes it's getting someplace. But the two don't have to be opposed also. It's possible to walk along the path to get to the end of the trail and to enjoy the walk as you walk. And that's kind of like what I like to emphasize. I like to see, you know, that as we engage in the practice of Buddhism, as we engage the practice of mindfulness, it's possible to do both at the same time. It's possible to appreciate the immediacy of presence, the immediacy of mindfulness, and enjoy it and enjoy each step along the way of our life by being fully here in the immediacy of now. And at the same time appreciate that as we do that, we're on a path that's onward leading, that's going on to greater freedom, to greater growth and development for us. So we become people who have more to offer this world of ours. I think this world has a tremendous need for people who are not so neurotic. And who have developed their capacity for being more peaceful, more free of conflict with themselves and the world around them, so that we can be more generous and compassionate and caring for everyone that we encounter in this world of ours. So three notions of the path, three approaches to the path. I hope that's just one path and three different lanes. So enjoy your path. So thank you.